kadar yoğun arttın sen? I mean, you know, I had a young woman named Ms. Whitman, who was also a woman. All right, good morning, gentlemen. It's a privilege to be with you. My passionate voice isn't so passionate. It's until I see you guys and have a chance to talk to you. Actually, I came to collect the rent. I don't know if anyone knows. The rent is due. We are, you know, the right kind of relationships are the ones that are not parasitic, but are symbiotic. It's not where I have a relationship where I get something and the other party doesn't. The pleasure of having Torah Shraga as part of the Yeshiva University in Israel campus is very much a mutual one. We have a wonderful Gris Kollel, and I know that you have relations with lots of the students who are there, and you're part of a lot of the activities that go on here. But understand that you and your quest for learning and your vitality really also bring life to the enterprise, and it's really important. It's also important for me that you see role models who are here because of what their parents and Yeshiva University did. I'd like to say that's why I want you to see the Kollel guys, but I could also say that's why I'd like you to see your own Rabbein. Because, you know, manufacturing companies, when they want to talk about what they produce, they talk about their profits, but they also talk about their product. You know, here's Wheaties. This is our cereal. Well, we don't get to talk about our profits because we don't make them. I give a class at the Yeshiva Amstern, actually at Sims, on leadership for the not-for-profit world. And that's because allegedly I'm in a position of leadership and I'm absolutely an expert on not making a profit. But what we do have is our product. And you know, I often talk about the fact that in Chutz La'aretz and in the Americas, if you take away YU, you take away the Rabbanim, and you take away the Mechantim, and you take away the support that we give for both, and you take away maybe the most important product, which is the graduates of YU who are serious lay leaders, and look at the communities around and look at who's in important positions, if you take that away, there's a crumbling, certainly Orthodox community, but I say more than that, because the 90% of the Jews who are not Orthodox are in need of leadership. And I don't mean leadership people who will be Makari of them and make them Orthodox. I don't mean that at all. But the future of Knesset Yisrael is really dependent on the Jews knowing that they're Jews and thinking there's some pride in that. And that comes, right, when people share with them what Jewish values are and what Jewish life is. And increasingly, you're going to have to serve as Shevet Levi from Bnei Yisrael. You're going to have to be involved in Avodah, in service to God. You're going to have to be involved in, like the Levim, being the Mechanchim and being those who sing songs for the Jewish people and help us be a light to the world. Even for the Haredi community, increasingly, our being open to that world is something that's sought by that community because they look to issues of what's next for them and how to go on. It was just actually last night or this morning, I don't know what it was, in conversation with Rev. Aaron Cutler from Lakewood about some issues of mutual interest. Right? The world is going to go on if we decide that it's a world. If we think it's just a bunch of fractious noises, then we're all in trouble. So I'm delighted to be here. You're an important yeshiva. Certainly, one of the reasons I come here is because you get to see a lot of Yeshiva University personalities, so why should you be punished with the president as well? But also part of it is, look, you are, I have six children. Right? They have, four of them are married, so I have four daughters and sons-in-law. As of about 4 weeks ago, I have seven grandchildren, right, with number eight on the way, please God, in April. I've been living with my best friend for 41 and a half years. My life has been a wonderful and wondrous journey. Chaval, I'm the first president of Yeshiva University who's not a Rav. I'm also the first president of Yeshiva University whose son is a Rav. And some of you have probably lost the basketball to him in Cleveland. Anybody here from Cleveland? Wait, just you? So he's okay, right? Okay, good. When you email him, tell him I said hi and I didn't embarrass him too badly in public. So I have a wonderful life. I'm a recovering lawyer. I went into law for... It's like having a malaria. Get cured, but not completely cured. You can always fall back into it. I was a lawyer because I wanted to make the world better. I'm not sure that you have to be lucky in law for it to be about making the world better. But I was an assistant district attorney in the Bronx. I was law and order. Maybe I was order of law and order. I'm not sure. And I did that for 4 years, and then somehow I had my career perfectly planned. I was invited to teach law at Cardozo, which is Yeshiva's law school. And then become associate dean for 8 years, after which I was going to go practice law on Wall Street. And my wife was unhappy, saying that there are enough good Jewish lawyers and it won't make me happy. Out of the blue, I was recruited to be the president and the international director of Hillel. I spent 15 years building up YU's competition. The only thing I did know was that I would never be president of Yeshiva University because I'm not a Rav and I'm not a Gaon. As my predecessors largely were. But God does, and here's a great lesson for you, God exercises his macabre sense of humor and has plans for you. And if you're lucky, you listen to those voices. So Yeshiva 11 years ago was looking for its next direction and spent a lot of years kind of searching. And then finally they gave up and came after me. And I've been on a journey for 11 years, and it's been the privilege of a lifetime. University presidencies are extremely challenging. It's like, it's like running a city or a state. It's increasingly the same kind of pressures that a mayor will have or any other president will have. On the other hand, I have a product that's real special, so it's good. So I want to talk to you not about YU, I want to talk to you about life and see if I can just add some value from my perspective as a recovering lawyer and someone who gets to be a teacher, and that's very exciting to me. So, about 3 years ago, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania who has spent most of his time being a prominent Republican pollster named Frank Luntz wrote a book based on survey research he had done, and the name of the book was What Americans Really Want. And he did lots of studying of the questions of what do Americans really want. And I was very taken by the centerpiece of the book, which was a survey asking to find out the five things that Americans want most. And what are the five things that Americans want most? Okay, so now comes the audience participation part of the program. What do you think Americans said they want most? Five things. Raise your hand. Ray, don't yell at me. Yes, sir. Money. Okay. What else? Sir?
Family. Time.
Happiness. Sir?
Family. Woman.
What's that? Woman?
Men?
Yes. Is that the men Americans who want women? Who are you? Okay, we got two families and one woman. Yes, sir.
Stature.
Okay.
Health.
Power.
Job.
Okay. Not bad. Not right. Not bad. These are the five things that Americans want most, according to Frank Luntz. Number one, who said money? You're almost right. They don't want money. Number one, more money. I mean, interesting, we'll talk about it in a minute. More money. Number two, fewer hassles. Number three, more options. Number four, more time. And number five, no worries. No worries. More money, fewer hassles, more options, more time. No worries. So let's talk about it a little bit. I made a big deal about saying more money, not just money. Society's hard today. As your parents can tell you, and as you know yourselves, particularly in the United States, but I guess here too, money matters. Money matters because we live in a society where we are marketed to every minute. But it's very interesting, well, and therefore, right, oh, I want this, and you need this, and some of it you really need, and the cost of food, the cost of education. So money is important, but I also am told every day, I'm barraged with information about what else I can buy. What else I can buy. Money's really important. But the survey didn't say money. It said more money. More money. It's not a survey of one particular socioeconomic group. Okay? The desire is more. Whatever I have, I want more. And I think that's interesting because I think a lot of us in the United States associate self-worth with self-worth. Right? I'm valuable if I have more money. I just have to stop to say hello to Rabbi Schneider, who we go back many years. I had the zechus of having him as a ben bayit and friend of my children, and Rebbe of my son. So, hakar satov. More money. Okay. Number two, fewer hassles. We understand that there's lots of hassle in life now. I'm surprised that it was number two. But the hassles are little things that just make doing everything harder. Right? The classic example I use is years ago, if you needed a pair of scissors, right? So you'd go to the hardware store, right? You'd ask for a pair of scissors, they'd take the pair of scissors, they'd put it in the bag, you'd give them the money, you'd walk home and you'd have the scissors. Now, there are all these laws that are protecting us from hurting ourselves. So like many other items, the scissors come in a protective plastic, hard plastic container. Right? So they give you the scissors in the hard plastic container, you pay for it, you go home, and you want to use the scissors. And here's this hard plastic container. Right? And what do we do? You know what we do. First we look for where the two pieces of plastic, right, come together to see if we can just split it open, and of course we never can. And then we look around on the container, we must be missing something. There has to be a place, right? There has to be a place that says, pull here. But there's never a place that pulls here. Right? Then you look and you say, I can't do this. You start banging it on the table and nothing happens. Then you all know what's next, right? You look around to make sure your parents aren't around. What do you do next? Bite it! Of course you bite it. You don't want to say it. You don't want to say it. You bite it. The only thing that breaks is your tooth. Right? And you're really frustrated. Somebody walks by and says, what are you doing? I'm trying to open this thing. They say, why don't you use a pair of scissors? I said, it's in there! It's a hassle. It's a hassle. It's silly. But there's lots of sillies that just make everything seem like, I don't want the hassle, please. Next, more options. Why do you think they're saying more options? Why do you think they're saying more options?
They're bored.
They're bored. Okay. What else? Yes?
They're not satisfied
with what they are or what they have. I mean, you think in America there are all these options. They want more options. I think you both said it exactly right. There's a dissatisfaction with what is for them, and they want something else. Either because they're bored and they want more things to do, or because the place that they're at, they're saying, is this it? Is this who I am? Is this where I'm going to be? I want more options. I think that's right. More time. What does that mean?
What does that mean? More time.
I want more time. Well, America is about the most overworked society there is. People work all the time. I don't know if we have to. It's just what we do. And now, because despite God's desires, someone invented this, right? Time has no boundaries. Work has no boundaries. Right? You go home, and there's the cell phone, and there's the email, and there's the text, and there's the WhatsApp, and there's Facebook, which my wife doesn't let me have, thank God. But in terms of time, do you know, there was a study that said the average American spends 6 hours a day, right, on this device. 6 hours a day. Now, I mean, if we can talk philosophically and say, one of the scary things for me is that you spend more time texting than you do speaking on the phone. Communication is now one step back. We won't even talk about how things have changed. You know, when I grew up, there was a why in you. There was a why in you. You never see a why in you anymore. When I grew up, there were adjectives. There are no adjectives anymore. Now it's not an opinion. But let's go back to the time. On average, we check our cell phones 34 times a day. Now before you react, think about how often you check your cell phones. And on average, Americans check their cell phones every 10 minutes. I think back to the time we had no cell phones, I don't know what we did with all that time. There's also a question of how much that distracts you and takes time, and you say, I want more time. I think there's a tremendous desire for that. But it's also interesting, because time is very special. You know, we talk a lot about spending money, number one, but there's another expression, spending time. Right? Which one's more valuable? So I always talk about the fact that money is a credit card, and time is a debit card. Right? Money, you have a credit card, you put money on the credit card, you go out, you buy things, and you spend money, and when the credit card runs down, you put more money on it, right? Then you get to spend more, and you do more, and boy, you're spending money. But time is a debit card. Right? You're born, you're given this card. It has a certain amount on it. You don't even get to know what it is. And every day, whether you want to or not, you are sending down that debit card. And there's nothing you can do to change the amount on that debit card. So when we think about our lives, what's more precious? What's more expensive? The credit card or the debit card? Time or money? Well, time is more precious. Tehillim says to us, "Lemnos yomein yotein hodav and adil levav chacham." Teach us how to number our days so that we can attain a heart of wisdom. Another way to say that is that we have to count time so that we make time count. We're about to read the first mitzvah that we get as a people. Achodesh hazeh lachem rosh chodashim. It's very interesting. First of all, it's the first mitzvah we get when we're not slaves anymore, and the message is clear. A slave has no control of time. A slave is owned by time. A ben chorin owns time. And the first way we show that, right, is by being mevarech hachodesh. Is establishing the month. But there are two levels to that. First of all, we look at the moon. It's not birkas hakama. Why aren't we blessing? We're free now, we're going to bless the sun. The sun is a constant. The moon waxes and wanes, comes and goes back, renews itself. So the first message is, look at the moon. Just like the moon gets to engage in hitchatshut, in renewing itself, so do you. Time, you get to do something with that time. But maybe the more important point is the message of being Mekadesh HaKodesh, is that now that you're free, you get to be God's partner in being Mekadesh HaKol. What do I mean? Okay, so we know that Shabbos is Kodesh. How do we know Shabbos is Kodesh? God tells us. How do we know when Shabbos is? God's established it. Every 7 days, we have Shabbos. Who makes Yantar Kodesh? We do. How do we do that? We set Rosh Chodesh. It's in our hands. It's Rosh Chodesh, and then it counts 15 days. We create the Kedusha of Yantar. We're God's partner, the master lesson. Now that you're free, you're about to engage in a journey, you're about to receive the Torah. It's going to be something that guides you in building your life. What do you have to know? You have to know that you are not the animal on the highest point of the food chain. Rather, you are Kemat Elohim. You're a little lower than the angels. You're created B'Tselem Elohim. And B'Tselem Elohim, you get to be God's partner. Kedoshim Tihiyu Ki Kadosh Ani Hashem. Be noble, just like God is noble. And we show that just as we're coming free by being Mekayim that first mitzvah. So for us, time is more than just something we spend. It's something we invest in. Time is something that gives us the opportunity to say, hey, it's not just about schlepping along. It's about more than that. So that's Kedushat, that's time. That's time. And then no worries. Who doesn't want no worries? So here's what Americans want most. More money, fewer hassles, more options, more time, no worries. What do we want? What do we want? Is that our list? Would you make that your list? What do we want? Back to you again. What do you want? Serious question. What do you want? Give me your answer, not the right answer.
Purpose.
Purpose. Good first answer. What do you mean by that?
What I'm doing, why I'm doing it, meaning trying what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Be happy? What do you want? What do you want? Final question. What do you want? Sir?
Peace.
Health. Health.
Simplicity.
Simplicity. Well, that's interesting. Such a complicated world, just make it simple, right? Would you be happy with simplicity? There's something to think about. No worries. Hey, a pure American here. Have less worries. Okay, yes? Oh, I'm sorry. Anybody else? Go ahead.
Satisfaction.
Purpose, satisfaction. I see you're supposed to be here. Okay, good. Happiness, purpose, satisfaction. Less worries. Health.
Higher purpose.
Higher purpose. What do you mean by that?
Not just that you have purpose, but you're doing it for something greater than yourself.
And what's something greater than yourself?
Religion.
Is it religion?
Judaism.
Is it Judaism?
I'm
just keep pushing you. Is it Judaism?
God.
Oh, okay. That's a God. Yes, yes, yes. I'm not challenging you. I'm agreeing with you. But you know, sometimes we build so many steps, right? We're doing Jewish, but what's the Jewish, right? Ultimately. And it's not just sit around and have a sense of God. But ultimately, we believe that we're not alone. Ultimately, we believe that there's a creator. Right? Ultimately, we believe there's a special purpose. So let me take it from there a little bit. So last week in Parsha Shmos is a wonderful story that I always like a lot, and I particularly like to tell, and you'll see why. You know that it's the story of the patriarch of the Rabbeinu family, Moshe, right? And we know that the Torah, tells us that Moshe is in the house of Paro, right? He is being raised as the royalty of Egypt, and we're told that one day he leaves the palace, right, to go out at home, to go to his brothers. By the way, just derech agav, is it clear that Moshe thinks the people he's going to see are his brothers, or is the narrator just telling us that the people he's going to are his brothers? There's some machlokas on that. I believe that he knew. How could he be raised by Yocheved and not know that he might be prince of Egypt, but he's also the child of Hebrew slaves? So here's Moshe going out of the palace, going to his brothers. And what does he see? He sees an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew. I tell the story because I like saying the word smiting. Maybe I have a chance to say smite. So Moshe sees an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, and then the pasuk goes on and says, what? Vayifan kol v'cho, vayarki ein ish. And he looks hither and yon. You get to say hither and yon. It doesn't happen every day. Vayarki ein ish, and he sees that no one's there. I got a smite, I got a hither, and I got a yon. Right? So Moshe goes out, he sees an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, Vayifan kol v'cho, and he looks here and there. Vayarki Yehish, and he sees there's no one there. And what does he do? He kills the Egyptian and buries him in his sand. How do we understand Vayifan kol v'cho Vayarki Yehish? So Kipshuto, it's, there he is, he's prince of Egypt, he wants to do something, doesn't want to get out. He looks here and there, Vayifan kol v'cho Vayarki Yehish, he sees that no one's watching, and he does what he has to do. It's Pasha, except of course the next day someone knew what he had done, so either the Hebrew told, or someone watched. Okay, number two, Here he is, Prince of Egypt. He cares about his brothers. He sees something bad going down. He doesn't want to get involved. Vayifan Kovacho, he says, somebody ought to get involved. He looks around, Vayarki Yanish, and there's no one there. And he learned Pirkei Avot in the morning, and he learned the Mekom She'enam Hashem Yishtadel Yelpish, where there is no man, strive to be a man. And he acted. And he acted. There's a third way of looking at it that I resonate with. That this is really a cathartic moment for Moshe. This is that special moment that we hope for at least once in our lives, but often in a recurring way. Right? Here's Moshe, living a little bit of a schizoid life, or a multifaceted life. Right? He's Prince of Egypt, he's Hebrew slave. Prince of Egypt, Hebrew slave. He now has this moment where the two come together in conflict. What do I do? Vayifen kol v'cho. And he looks into himself. He looks here, he looks there. Vayar ki einish. He said, who's the person here? Who's the person? It's that moment of decision for Moshe to say, who am I? Who am I? He has the money, he has the options, he has the time, he has no worries. And yet, he's part of, I have no time, I have no money, I have no options, I have only worries. Vayifan kol v'cho v'yar ki einish, and he looks into himself and says, who am I? And he decides. And he decides, and it changes and shapes his entire life. His entire life. And he begins his journey that is our journey from Galut to Geula. What do we want? What we want involves that kind of confrontation. We have to say, who am I? Who am I? What makes me? Okay? There's never a place where you'll have more of an opportunity to look deeply into yourself and to look deeply into your future and to have the guidance of people who are focused on caring about you and having the growth of owning the Torah, that you have now. Please God, it should continue for many years, but now is a moment. Right? Vayifen kol v'cho v'yar ki einish. Who are you? Who are you? Well, I have some answers. Because I know you, but I don't know you. But it doesn't matter what my answers are. It matters what your answers are. And I hope you're engaging in that. And by the way, we keep asking that. I'm 64 years old. I can't believe I'm 64 years old. I think I'm 37. I spent all my life playing with young people. But you always say, is this who I am? Am I doing what I should be doing? Do I believe what I believe? You don't just sit and ponder that. You kind of mechazek yourself with that and you move forward. But now is a good time. Who are you? So I have a friend named the very Reverend Father Joseph McChain. Joe McChain is the president of Fordham University, which is why he's my friend. Because several of us always spoke, presidents spoke to each other on the cloud that misery loves company. And Joe's a terrific guy. He's a Jesuit priest, runs Fordham University. I don't feel a sense of competition because usually the same student isn't choosing between yeshiva and Fordham. Although interestingly, one of my closer friends is John Sexton, who's the president of NYU. We'll talk about that too. And Joe loves the Jews. And I've made the practice two or three times a year to have lunch with him because he loves kosher restaurants. And we go to kosher restaurants. Joe is still under the impression, despite his experience at it, that everybody who works in a kosher restaurant is a Jew. So I go through, like a litany, a series of Hispanic and Irish waiters who come to the table and he says, are you Orthodox, conservative, or Reformed? And they say, I'm not Jewish. He says, what are you? I'm Catholic. And then we go into a whole discussion of what parish they belong to. And we have one. So about 4 years ago, he asked to come to Yeshiva University because he wanted to see our base medrash. I do that a lot. Every year I have 19 cardinals who come to YU who want to see our base medrash. I'm much more popular with the Catholics than I am with the Jews. And it seems like more of them want to see my base medrash. But at that point, But at that point, Joe wanted to come. He also wanted to come because he knew I'd serve him a kosher lunch. A woman named Mary served the lunch, so he got to talk about another parish. And then we went to the Beis Medrash. Why did he want to go to the Beis Medrash? Because the way that we are and the way that we learn is different. The problem facing the Catholic Church, and in fact the problem facing most of the Jews, right, is if in Catholicism you want to be really learned, you train to be a priest. And if you're a layman in the Catholic Church, you don't know much. You just know what the priest will tell you. Same thing in Judaism and the liberal movements. If you want to know something, you know, you hire a designated know person, which is a rabbi. And as we see, the terrible cost of that. If you don't own the text, if you don't own this life, then you are a step removed from it. So they love coming and seeing we're regular guys. Not all of them are going to be rabbis. 85% of them are not. And they walk into the Beis Medrash. They went into the old Beis Medrash, which is in the building of MTA. Right? They saw 450 guys, right, with a sacred cacophony, a din of screaming and yelling as they're learning. It's not they're sitting there reverently with someone telling them the Word of God. They're owning the Torah. You gave this to me, it's mine. And they're struggling, in different languages. And he found it amazing. You walk out of the Beis Medrash, your tears coming down his eyes. He says, Richard, you have no idea how sacred this place is. I said, yeah, I have a little idea. We walk out of the building, MTA building, there is a bench in front of the building, and there are three prepubescent young men who are obviously ninth graders in MTA. And I look at them, and they look really, you know, downtrodden. I said, everything okay, guys? They said, oh, we missed our bus. I said, where are you from? I said, Hillcrest, Holliswood, and Jamaica States. I said, can I help you? They said, no, they're getting us another vehicle. So I didn't know, you know, when to stop. So I said, well, by the way, I'm Richard Joel. I work for you. Now they said, oh my God, what's going on here? And let me introduce you to my friend. This is Father Joseph McShane, who's the president of Fordham University. And they're saying, I didn't know there was a punishment for missing the bus. And he looks at them and says, Shalom! And they look at me like this. And I say, say the Shalom. They say, Shalom. Well, he's not to be deterred. He says, do you speak Hebrew? Now they're saying, I should have gone to Hafter. I should have gone to Hafter. Right? I said, tell Father McGinn. They said, yes, we do. Then he goes and says, biblical or modern? I said, gee, we have to go. Bye. And I take him away. We walk, and they're benching Gomer. We get about 25 feet away, and Joe stops and says, oh, Richard, I have to go back. I forgot something very important. I have to go back. So he goes back to these guys who thought they had escaped, and here comes the second coming. And he comes there and he stands in front of them. And he says, boys, I forgot something very important. He says, you must listen to me. You must listen to me. You must keep the covenant alive. You must keep the covenant alive. And don't miss the bus again. And he comes back to me. And now I have tears in my eyes. I said, Joe, that was beautiful. He says, you don't understand. The world doesn't go on if the Jews don't keep their covenant with the Creator. You're our older brothers. I didn't want to get into a theological discussion with him. But from his dishes, he felt that the role of the Jews in order to keep the world alive is to keep the covenant alive. And we don't think that way. And it occurred to me as I looked a little ahead that one of the greatest expressions, what does that mean, keep the covenant alive? One of the greatest expressions of it is in Parshas Yisro. It's in Parshas Yisro, clear as day. Perek Yutes, you know this, but let me translate to Hebrew. Moshe Allah El Elokim, and God went. And Moshe went up to God. Vayikra, I love Hashem in Hahar Lemar. And God called to him from the Har, from Har Sinai. Lemar saying, Kos Samar Leves Yaakov. So you should say to the women, V'tagid Levnei Yisrael, and tell the men, Atem Re'isem Asher Asisi L'Mitzrayim. You saw what I did to Egypt. And how I lifted you up and took you out on the wings of eagles. And I've brought you to me. The atah. And now. What's a covenant? It's a contract. Right? A covenant is a contract between two bodies. What's the covenant? The atah. Im shamoa tishma'u l'chali. If you listen to my voice. Ushmartem es brisi. And you guard our covenant, my covenant. And you make yourselves chosen to me. Mic shot. We're not the chosen people, we're the choosing people. And you make yourselves chosen to me. The whole earth is mine. If you do that, if you listen to my voice, and if you guard our agreement, and if you make yourselves chosen to me, then what's the deal? What do you get? You get to be a kingdom of Kohanim and a noble nation. That's a kingdom of Kohanim. What's the deal? That we get to be the keepers of the relationship between humanity and God. We get to be the singers, and we get to be the teachers, and we get to be those who assist in teaching about Karban and bringing close to God. The guy kadosh, and a noble people. A noble people. What's kadosh? Kadoshim ti yu ki kadosh ani Hashem. Mahu afata. Imitati odei. We imitate God. The deal is, if we accept the Torah and accept God and choose God and live by God's words, we get to model nobility and sanctity to the world. And be God's partners in building a stronger world. I think it's powerful. I think when you say, who am I? Here's an opportunity as individuals and as a people to say, no matter what our numbers, no matter how corrupt things seem in the Jewish community and in the world, we made a deal. We made a deal. And God promises that we get to do that if we keep that deal. It seems to me, with no baloney, that that's what's so special about it. And how do we do it? We have to know something. You have to learn Torah. You have to think about what matters in your life. What most young people are thinking today, thank God, is saying, what's purpose? What's meaning? A better way to say it, how do I get to matter? One of the reasons is the world is now so small. Coming in at your face. You don't just hear about a terrorist attack in France. We wallow in it. Everything in the news, and everything on CNN, and everything that doesn't go away. The crash of the Malaysian airliner doesn't go away. You get reports every 2 minutes. Several years ago, we experienced the tsunami that was there. It was there day after day. Years ago, you'd hear about it, and it would be there, and it would be part of the world. But it's all up close now. It's all up close. And everything around you is up close. How many friends do you have on Facebook? I'm not going to ask you if they're your friends. How many friends do you have on Facebook? Everything is in your face, and we have no power to do anything about it. I can't do a blessed thing about what happened in France. I can't find the black box flight recorder in the Sea of Java. But it's there. So what do I feel? I feel powerless. I feel more powerless than I ever did. So what do we want? We want to say, I'm not powerless. I can matter. I can matter. I have to tell you, in order to matter, you have to know something. And you have to be part of a community. And you have to have a collective purpose that you can pursue individually and collectively. You have to be part of a klal with meaning. So you know this. You come in a place of, I'm a graduate of MTA. I had such a wonderful experience at MTA that wild horses couldn't get me to White. Wild horses. One of the reasons I took the job as president of YU was I resolved that MTA would be a wonderful school and nobody would be like me. I spent a year, I was 14 years old, my father died. I spent a year saying mincha in the Beis Medrash at YU and saying Kaddish. And for that entire time, not one living human being came over to me or put their arm around me or acknowledged my presence. I said, I can't. So I went to NYU. Had a real good experience. a real good experience, and I probably would have been fine. It was challenging. My best friend was a Catholic guy named Maurice Laban. His friend was Darlene Culhane, a nice Catholic girl who, and her friends who lived at Fordham, which was nearby. NYU used to have its main campus up across from YU. And I remember I'd always go with him over to their apartment at Fordham, and we'd all be great friends. And I do remember one New Year's Eve when I was invited to their apartment. And they knew I was from, I was there in their apartment New Year's Eve, and about 10 to 12, a very nice girl named Kathy came over to me with a glass of champagne, not kosher, of course, and sat on my lap and said, "Happy New Year." And I had one of those moments. I said, "Whoa, is this who I am? Is this why?" Thank God I had one of those moments. Although the champagne might have been nice. And Kathy might have been. I said, this isn't me. And thank God at the same time, I've been, why YU's across the road. And I've become involved in youth programs and retreat programs of YU. So all my friends became YU people, and I was asked to be involved in that. And I also was invited to a Shabbaton in my own shul, where I met this girl who had everything. She was frum, and she was beautiful, and she was popular, and she was terrific. And we started talking. We stayed up most of Friday night talking. This was it. This was it for me. When the Shabbaton was over, I walked her to her car, but I didn't have the nerve to ask her out, because I wasn't a YU guy. And there were all these popular guys, and they were all interested in her. And she was very nice to me, and she asked me if I was planning to go to Yeshiva University's Torah Leadership Seminar at Camp Marashah the end of the summer. I said, "Well, I really hadn't thought of it." She said, "You really ought to go." I said, "Will you be there?" She said, "Yeah." So I moped around for 3 days, and I got chutzpah that I never have to go to YU, to go to what was then called the Community Service Division. And I went into a guy who was in charge, and I said, "Excuse me, do you have any positions for advisors at the seminar this summer, Marashah?" And he looked at me and he said, "No." I said, "Okay," and I thank you very much. I turned around and started walking out. He said, "Wait a minute." He says, "Do you have any talent?" I said, "Beg your pardon?" He says, "Do you do anything?" So I play the accordion, and I sing a little bit, and he looks at me and says, "Sing for me." He said, "I beg your pardon." He said, "Sing for me." And then they're going to plaque up, I'm going to put a plaque up on that door one day. So I remember singing, "Torah, Torah, Torah, Tzivolam, Moshe, Morasha, Kihilasya, Hakov." Ask your parents. And he looked at me and said, "No, I'll take a chance on you. You'll come in as an advisor and as an auxiliary music man." So I get up to Morasha in August, and I get off the bus, and I'm right there at the Chadar Ochel and in the canteen in the distance. I see this vision of loveliness. And I walk towards her, and I say, "Hi." And she looked right through me. And I said, "You here for seminar?" She said, "I was going up, but I had a rough year. I was the head of the waterfront. I'm going home." And she left. And I was there by myself with all these people. And it was an opportunity for me, fortunately, I sing loudly enough that people don't hear how terribly I played the accordion. But I was a music man, and I became popular. And at the end of this program, the director asked me if I could be the head advisor for a new program they were starting for yeshiva kids. But the staff had already been chosen, but they didn't have a head guy. So I said yes. It was very exciting. And around November, we had our first meeting with advisors, and I was introduced to my girl's head advisor. Who was that girl? And we've been married 41 and a half years. So do I owe Yeshiva University like more than my life? I owe it more than my life. Can you plan this out? You can't plan this out. But that enabled me to be part of the YU world again. And that enabled me to have my center in terms of where I was going. No more New Year's Eve with Kathy and Trey Champagne. Now, we're not all facing New Year's Eve with Kathy and Trey Champagne. But we need to be in a place where we get to keep the covenant alive. And we get it alive now on my thing. I have this is my YU presidential pin. And it has the alma mater of Yeshiva, which is Torah Umaba. And of course, you can talk for hours and days and weeks about Torah and Mada. It's Torah and Mada. It's Mada and Torah. It's Ooh. I spend a lot of time talking about Ooh. I don't think it captures it quite. I mean, for me, it's kind of simple, that our life is based on Torah. And that through the lens of Torah, we welcome the other Muslims of the world that God created. We welcome, through the lens of Torah, arts and science and commerce and culture and poetry and prose, and using all of that to build a life of joy and purpose and a meaningful world. And so that doesn't all say Torah Umada. What it does say to me is the word Shlemut, wholeness. Another word for wholeness is integrity. I think our lives have lots of pieces through them. And the job really is, how do we make the pieces fit? How do we make the pieces fit so that it's not fractious? Now, what's shalom? I'm a very concerned with about shalom. Is shalom the absence of war? Shalom is shlemut. Is may God bless us that our pieces can come together as individuals, as a family, as a people, as a world. I know where I live, at Kashid University, there is a great and wonderful celebration of and growing in Shlemut. How do I become whole? I know that I have kind of the largest network of young men and women on any university in the world who know each other, who form a network. You know, when you get to law school and you're choosing between Cardozo and Harvard, you should choose Harvard. Not because the education is so much better, but the kind of network of friends that you're going to have and what they're going to do in life will really give you tremendous business possibilities. I mean, you go there for the network. On an undergraduate level, what YU offers, Harvard doesn't offer. Right? This is Harvard helps you make a living. Yeshiva helps you build a life. And then get you to Harvard. I have 4 undergraduates this year of my 1,500 students at Yeshiva College who started at Harvard Law this year. Compare that to any other school of the same size and see if you have that. Right? But in terms of what your life is about your undergraduate years. Your life is about who your best friends are. Your life is about how rugged are you in the learning of Torah. Your life is about how am I taking high-level academic courses in liberal arts and sciences or in business? How am I part of a community that wants to help me find the next place? How am I in a place where the academics is surrounded by chesed, by tutoring projects, by service learning trips to Israel, by a dramatic society, by several newspapers, by 16 NCAA teams where you can be 5'11" and possibly be the center? By the way, this year, our Maccabees, 9-3. 9-3, we're going to win the division, and we're going to go to the Nationals. 9-3. A little under 6. We're at a place where, and by the way, you don't have to decide whether you're going to play on Shabbos or not. And you don't have to decide whether you're wearing a yarmulke or not. But it's not what you don't have to do. There is a passion moving forward. Now I want to finish this way. Some of you, many of you, are going to allow me to work for you next year or the year after. And I look forward to that. Many of you are not. Many of you are not. And you're going to be fine. And you're going to be fine. You'll go to different places, but you're only going to be fine if you know what you're facing. So first I need to tell you, having worked for Hillel for 15 years, and of course I'm engaging in generalities, but I'll stand by them. The culture of the campus is really inimical to the culture of Frumkite. It's inimical. Now, I built Hillels for 15 years. I think they're great places. I built them for the 90% of the Jews who are not Orthodox. Because they haven't rejected Yiddishkeit, they've just never felt it. And it's an opportunity for them to feel. And we also said to those people for whom YU is not right, there should be 10 or 15 places where we can go, and you can have real kashrut, and you can have a rav who can learn with you, and you can have a friendship group, and you can have programs that you can do. But none of you are going to go to Hillel University. Right? You're all going to go to other universities that have a retreat center called Hillel. And you need to choose well to get the good one. But understand, at campus, our lives is about being part of a collective. We don't dance around the Shabbos table alone. We do, but then we're arrested and put in prison.
Looking psychiatric. On campus, the culture now is strongly individualistic. It's about me. Even us, when Hillel said it, he said, "It ain't on me. If I'm not the me, who am I?" But he put a semicolon after it. He said, "Bishani la'atzmi ma'ani. If I'm only about me, what am I?" And then he said, "In la'ashah ne'matai. You've got to act now." But on campus, it's about me. Also, we believe in a certain way in Kedushat HaGuf. We need our space. Right? Campus really believes in casual intimacy. That we don't have to think about it, Kedushat HaGuf. Campus doesn't believe in any orthodoxy, not just Jewish. It believes in lots of truths out there. Experience them all. Try them all. No one's is better than anybody else's. And that's what it is about. Now, when you have the right Hillel, the right Chabad, there, it could be your community. But I also plead with you to do one more thing. Write a contract to yourself. Nobody else has to see it, but write it down. Take it with you. Take it to campus. Say a few things on it. Number one, write down your non-negotiables. This is who I have to be and stay here. I'm not going to do this. I am going to do this. This is how I feel about Saturday games. This is what I feel about davening. This is what I feel about who my friends are going to be. What are your non-negotiables, number one? Number two, asay lecha rav. Who's your rav that you're going to reach out to discuss issues that I guarantee you will arise? Wherever you are, you're going to have issues. Even at yeshiva. Asay lecha rav. Number three, what books you're going to read this year? Write them down. Number four, Toveya Itim LaTorah. What are you writing down is your commitment to learning. You're not going to do as much as you write down, but at least you'll write it down and you'll have something to do. And number five, center yourselves around the community where you can have your best friends who will share what you share. If you do that, and you really keep it uppermost in your mind, you'll really be fine. You'll have a great life, and you'll be able to live in YU communities after you get done. And I know these are hard choices. And I know that you think about it a lot and your parents think about it a lot. And I know I believe that the place where your future is going to be is through yeshiva, because I think that's the place where our world is going to be. But whatever it is, you're a great part of the future. I also have to tell you that some of you are thinking about, gee, I really would like to do it, but you know, I can't afford it. The answer is you can't afford it. The question is, do you want to afford it? In other words, you can go places that are free, and you're going to get exactly what you pay for. Free, you get exactly what you pay for. You can go to other schools and pay less. There is no school that will be more generous in making it work than we will be. And until you try, you won't know. That's one thing, our honor scholarships, where we kind of bribe you and say, this is the best place in the world. We spend more on you. We give you a fabulous honors Ivy League education, and we pay you for it. I haven't quite figured that out yet. I'm not sure I believe in it. But most of our scholarship is need-based. And you fill out a form, and we look at your needs. We take into account things that other schools don't. And we work to make it work. And even though all colleges, all universities that are private in the United States are going through a real crisis, because the business model of the university doesn't work anymore, we're focused on saying our product is you. So I think people will have to bend. I think they'll have to meet halfway. I think there sometimes have to be loans. Right? But if you want to be there, and your parents want to work with us, we're going to make it work. We're going to make it work. That shouldn't be the thing. Enough why you. I'm going to end with a story. A story about a little boy who's sitting on his dining room chair at the dining room table with a big piece of butcher block paper in front of him at the table. And in front of him are crayons and pencils and magic markers and pens. And he's busily scribbling away. His mother walks into the room, looks down at him and says, "My child, what are you doing?" The kid looks up and says, "Me? I'm drawing a picture of God." The parent looks down at the child and says, "My child, don't you know? Nobody knows what God looks like." Kid looks up and smiles and says, "Well, they'll know when I'm finished. They'll know when I'm finished." So look, your parents and your schools and your teachers,
have put before you this big piece of butcher block paper. They've given you pens and crayons and magic markers and pencils. They didn't give you some art courses. Your job now is to paint the picture of God and share that picture and that smiling face with the world. And I look forward to your being able to do that. You'll do it with my children. Your children will do it with my grandchildren. And in that way, we'll build a better world. Thank you very much.
I know the prime question is, how is my son doing?
But you might have some other questions as well. I do want to tell you that I've been to Gush, and I've been to Shalavim, and they all have lots of questions. So no pressure. Any questions? The first one's always the hardest. About anything, about colleges, about YU, about life, about my grandchildren, about education, about what it's like to have a job. Pressure. Only the first question is bad. So somebody just decide, suck it up, and ask the first question. I will not let you in. You are trapped until somebody thinks of something to say based on what I said. Or else I'll be very depressed and I'll browbeat and say. Anything? Yes, sir. Who are you? Thank you.
Hello.
Who are you?
Hello.
From where?
From
New Jersey.
Okay. Are the games fun?
For the first time in years, there are hundreds of students who show up at the games. So they're lots of fun. For me, they're always fun, but I'm always wearing my uniform. Right? So I'm always going, am I smiling right? Is somebody looking at me now? Am I scratching here? And they're going to say, how come he's scratching his left nostril? So it's a little less fun for me, but it's a privilege for me. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And I'll tell you, the people on the teams now, you know, tennis team had a great year last year. Cross country had a great year last year. I think people are excited about their own possibilities. The softball team, the baseball team, baseball, softball, women's softball, men's baseball, they're up before 6 in the morning for practice because they daven together, and then they practice. It's a lot of commitment, but they love it. By the way, it's a lot of time at YU, but they all find time. They all make time. They know how important time is. Other question? Yes, sir, you are?
I think so.
From? Okay.
Is it easy to manage your time at YU?
No. No, most things worthwhile are not easy. Look, you go to Maryland and you go to NYU, you have 15 hours of class a week. A week. You go to YU, you probably have 8 to 10 hours of class a day. A day. And yet, all the students I know are either active in student government and Chesed programs, in NCAA teams, in student involvement, in night Seder in the Beis Medrash, and the first 2 months, getting that rhythm. I'm not saying you're not learning hard here, but there is a certain control over your time you have here. Getting that rhythm is a struggle. Once you get it, talk to our Madrichim over here. Who are Madrichim here? Okay, so talk to me. What's it like? Is it hard to climb?
It's definitely difficult, and as you said, when you're doing it, the first 2 months can be tricky to kind of get the groove, but there's no question that when you're sitting in interviews and you're explaining to future medical schools in those interviews, or if you're in Sims and you're trying to get a job at the Big Four, if you're going for accounting, they're impressed. There's no question that they're impressed that you can handle such a rigorous schedule, and that's what could put us at par with Harvard or with Yale or Columbia, because we can manage that kind of a schedule that those places can't.
Now, aside from being able to manage and get through an interview, do you get to have fun?
Absolutely.
How? How on earth do you get to have fun?
Well, there's a lot of different programs that YU runs. For example, in high school, I was very involved with Model UN, if you're kind of a nerd.
And when you're in college, it's YU students who run the Model UN, so it becomes one of their projects.
Right, right. And also, there's a lot more access to youth groups through YU. If you ever do Yachad or NTSY or B'nai Kiva or any of these things, the stop to go to Shabbaton is always on 186 in Amsterdam.
We have another mother here. Yeah, what do you say about this?
I say that.
Stand up so they can know who to target.
While you're there, there's so many options and so many different things you can do. You're things that are exciting and things that are fun. You make time because you want to do it. Don't feel forced to do things. Like, how am I going to put this in? You want to make time for it. Why do you have so many different avenues within your Jewish values that you want to do these things and they're fun? Of course you make time.
I think it's good to say for both crowds that the Beis Medrash is open till the middle of the night. The gym, the pool, and the exercise room are open until 2. The lounges, Wi-Fi, and co-ed, but you can sit by yourself, are open until 2. Extracurricular activities are every night. The problem is choosing them. So the answer is you get your rhythm. You know, it's like being a long-distance runner or by being a swimmer. You do it, and by the way, and you do model that for life. I'm always surprised at it because I'm guilty of having made the academics much more serious and learning much more focused. But it's a happier school, not a sadder school. Okay. Yes, sir, who are you?
Donnie Merwin, Los Angeles.
Okay.
You made it seem like, I was just a long time ago, but 40 years ago, people in my group were cold and not really like branching out to other people, like when you were saying foundation based. How have you seen a difference?
First of all, that's a if I said it that way, you understood it that way, it's a terrible injustice. There were always wonderful, terrific people, and there are alumni for whom it worked, and there were people who people did go over to in the base. It just wasn't me. Having said that, I'm not going to defend myself and say, yeah, it was too cold. It was a Lufthansa institution. We had great rabbis, but they weren't doing a lot of reaching out to their own community. And the administration, because they always thought there might not be enough money, was very minimalist, and said, this is good enough, there's no competition, they're going to come here, we're going to get our kids. Okay? It wasn't mean-spirited, it was survivalist. I'm the big knocker that's made it perfect, and I have a $40 million budget deficit. Would be nice to say just budget, right? Deficit. Right? So we have to figure out how not to lose that, but how to do that smart, and we're working on that. I think, how's it different now? I think speak to students. Everybody thinks they matter. I think the words, can I help you, is there. The symbolism of it is when I came to yeshiva, if you went to any door in yeshiva, outside door, there were one of two signs on the door. It either said, enter only, or exit only. I said, I have no idea what power I have, but let me try this. And I contacted the director of buildings and grounds. I said, could you strip those signs? And within a month, on every door, it said then and it says now, welcome to Yeshiva University. Okay, that's a silly little thing, but it changes all kinds of tone. I hired a vice president for Kavod HaBrios. His name was Zillow Davis. Right? And his job was to go place to place and figure out where we weren't being the covetous and make it warmer, empower people, make them feel good. I also think we've invested heavily in Rabbein, in Mashichin, in Svenei Mashichin, in Madrichin, in a counseling center which didn't exist the same way, in a career center, in a writing center, in an academic advisement center. We're filled with centers. Our RAs now, the dorm counselors, are seriously trained. They think that they're part of the student services part of the administration, because they are. Right? So it doesn't mean you're not going to have aggravation. It's not going to be someone's not going to, painting Shangri-La, it's not Shangri-La. Everybody counts. And if you think you're not being counted, you can go to someone and you'll get counted. And everybody finds their own cover. I also think it was more indrawn. Now I think it's broader. And I think it's broader but in a healthy way. I don't think there's another place on it. I don't think it also helped that we closed traffic on 185th Street in the summer to save the building of the pedestrian mall with grass and trees. I'm finally going to have trees. I think that's creating a campus with the new Beis Medrash and the new Beis Medrash building. Right? It brings the Beis Medrash right into the center of the campus. Even the lounges. Look, we're not a co-ed school. And we believe, first of all, without Hashkafa, we believe in separate sex education. And we also believe in Tzniut. But we also believe that there can be healthy and proper integration of the sexes for those who want it. So on most nights, there are a few hundred women up on the main campus, on the Wolf campus, and sometimes there are men at programs at the women's campus. We have 14 co-ed Shabbaton a year for those who want it.
Right? So there's a lot of healthy opportunity there. So that's what I mean. Other questions? That's it. You are? You are? From?
Looking back, do you regret going to NYU?
Yeah. Do I regret going to NYU? I had a very nice education at NYU because I was part of a special program called the Metropolitan Leadership Program in Arts and Sciences. So I had one of the first interdisciplinary undergraduate educations, which we do now at Yeshiva College as our core curriculum. And I wasn't interested in business. But I have one of the few enormous regrets in my life. See, I can't have a full regret because I ended up being very involved with YU, and all my friends were YU students. But here's the regret. I'm a high school educated Jew. No matter how long I live, the text is going to be an obstacle to me. I learn, I have chavrusas, I know a thing or two, but that text scares the hell out of me. And I have six children. All of them see the text as a friend. For me, I have to struggle through the text until I get to do what I really enjoy, which is the context. Right? That's a terrible price to pay. It's a terrible price to pay. And I didn't. Now I have. I'm very lucky. I'm president of yeshiva, so now I have lots of interaction with wonderful Rashi yeshiva. But I didn't have any of that. So yeah, it's a regret. I you know, if I were just here to sell, I'd say, oh, it's terrible. It wasn't terrible, but it was also University College, which was up in the Bronx on 40 acres of grass. Okay? I couldn't. My soul couldn't have been free in Washington Heights, and I didn't feel so much of an anonymous person. It's so huge that I don't know how I could negotiate it. That's a question. Anything else? Please, who are you?
I'm Austin Princeton from Princeton, New Jersey.
Princeton?
Yeah.
Please, Austin.
As the director of Yale for a while, what do you consider the biggest draft for students falling off there?
You heard the question? The director of Hillel for a long time, what do I think is the biggest threat for students falling off the derech? Well, most of the Jews on campus don't know that there is a derech. And you're going to be around them all the time, and you're either going to be translating it all the time, or you're going to see attractiveness in having more options. It's a little bit of a threat. You're going to have friends, and you're going to like the friends, because they're real nice people. But what they want to share with you is not what you want to share with them, and you might do more of that. Campus is not frightening, it's welcoming. It's welcoming, but it's alien. So the question is, if you're at a Princeton, does the Center for Jewish Life form enough of a nexus for you? I think the fear is what I asked you to make a contract about. I really believe these are years when you have to gain your Gilut and Torah. And if you're in a place where you have to be, now maybe you're the kind of personality who thrives being a miut shebamiut, then you'll find the way dafka to show that you can do that. Otherwise, it's hard. I think, look, we have really fine academic programs, and they're not limited academic programs, and we try to expose you to the wonder of the world of arts and science, and particularly now business. Right? But it's not presented as a challenge to your life values and a challenge to your life choices. It's part of the Shleimut equation. I think the environment is in your face every minute. And I'm not sure that any of you, having been here, will be off the derech and you'll be smoking cigarettes on Shabbos. But what will your struggle be if you're on a sports team and they play Friday night, but it's a home game? I think there's just a lot. It's not geared for you to grow as a Ben Torah. Do I think you will fall off the derech? I don't. Do I think you won't grow? I think you won't grow. I think you'll be in a holding action if you're lucky. And I think it's a waste of these years. And I also think you'll have a small cadre of wonderful friends, but there'll be a small cadre. And there's a shining city on the hill over there where you can get to choose among 3,000. So that, to me, is the cheshbon. But if you know what you want and you're determined to be who you're going to be, then you'll make it work. Then you'll make it work. Don't allow me to brainwash you. Any other questions? Well, you're a wonderful group. You did as well as Gersh, not as well as Shalom. It's a real pleasure. I have so much confidence that you're here in such wonderful hands. You also know that the Rabbi Josh Freilich is here to be your contact. He's based right in the building. For any questions you have about YU, any things you need, and you should take full advantage of him. He's also a wonderful man, so it's good to have
a chevra, maybe even a chevrusa. Make them learn a little bit. I also want to introduce Mrs. Jerry Mansell, who's the director of admissions at Yeshiva University. She's here with you. And I thank you very much. Hatzlacha. All the best.